If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, live from Shanghai. China fought hard to host the 2008 Olympics, and already a year before the Games, they wanted the world to know they were ready.
We are ready.
Now, with just 4 months to go to the opening ceremonies in Beijing, the preparations have been monumental. A city in many ways remade. And the challenges around the Olympics, monumental too. The whole world is watching. China is watching. This hour, On Point, we open a week of broadcasts from China with a look at China's Olympic debut. Back in 2001, here's the official announcement from then IOC President Juan Antonio Samaranch in 2001 in Moscow.
The Games of the 29 Olympiad in 2008 are awarded to the city of Beijing.
And there it is, here on Chinese CCTV with a gala during their 2008 Spring Festival, the Chinese New Year, just a couple of months ago. Well, here's how that expectation, that build-up sounded. It was a super gala broadcast all over China. You heard them saying there, we are carrying on the past and ushering in the future. We are on a course to complete our mission. We are the new Beijing. That's the sound of China. I've got a great panel to look at the Olympics and how they're playing out in China as the world watches them around the globe. With me from Beijing, first Melinda Liu, Beijing bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. She opened the bureau there in 1980. Melinda Liu, it's great to have you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Also in Beijing, professor of sociology at Tsinghua University, Jing Jun is with us. Jing Jun, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And with me in the studio in Shanghai, an old friend, David Westendorf. He's head of Urban China Partners. It's an urban governance and management consulting firm based in Shanghai, formerly with the UN Research Institute for Social Development in Geneva. David, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Tom, it's great to be here.
Melinda, first just paint Beijing for us, if you would. If you could just begin to describe the transformation of this city in preparation for the Games.
Tom, it's really hard to know where to start. This has been probably the most ambitious urban makeover transformation in the history of time, in terms of speed, in terms of scale. This is a city that has risen anew. Architectural marvels, not just one, but half a dozen, just stunning buildings, many of them Olympic venues or Olympic-related venues, designed by top-notch architects. We've seen entire neighborhoods raised to the ground and then rebuilt within days as parks, beautiful parks. I mean, trees appearing overnight, 20-foot-tall trees. It's a sort of a thing I've never seen in the West, because there's a whole different philosophy about, you know, gardening, everything from gardening to construction. The software is changing, too. I've got to say that the Olympics have become a symbol of China's confidence, attainment of big power status. And it's also the Olympics have become a sort of a symbol of China's rightful place among other large nations. Now, the dark side of this is that we've seen a sort of a nationalistic a surge in the wake of the unrest in Tibet in mid-March, a sort of a tendency from on the part of many Chinese to blame the bad publicity, the negative comments, the chaos of the torch relay and all this sort of thing, not only on the exiled Tibetan spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, but also on the West, the Western media. That's probably something that surprised everyone, including the Chinese leadership, who were always wondering, you know, would the people be behind us? And the good news is that the people are definitely behind the government on this. The bad news is maybe they're a little too much behind the government and a little too resentful of the West.
Jing Jun, there in Beijing as well. What about it? The Olympics looked tailor-made for China, and they still do in the promotions for the games that I see here in Shanghai endlessly on Chinese TV. Handsome athletes of many nations in the torch traveling, you know, on in these presentations anywhere, sort of noble and untouched around the world. But it's gotten a lot more complicated. Is the symbolism working out for China? Well, clearly, it's not exactly what they wanted or expected. But if it's not working exactly globally, is it still working domestically, internally, Jing Jun?
I think it works for a lot of ordinary people on the street of Beijing. And it hurts them in another aspect because of the fast urbanization. The city in year 2000 have 11 million people. Now the city has 16 million people.
Wow.
Because of the Olympic Games offered a lot of construction work, a lot of opportunities. People are pouring inside the city. And every day, 1,000 cars added onto the streets. So you have both sides. You have, you know, great opportunities coming in our way, but you also see, as Melinda just said, you know, a very fast destruction of traditional neighborhoods. But let's look at some of the bright sides, you know, by looking at some of the details. The Olympic Games, the Chinese government decided to make it into a smoke-free games. In other words,
banning smoking all around Beijing. I see there's trouble with that lately. The restaurant owners, as in America, are complaining about that, but maybe they will.
At least, you know, in the cabs, you know, every cab, you have a sticker that said no smoking, you know, please
no
do not
smoking
smoke.
In Beijing, incredible.
In Beijing, in the cabs. And that's one thing. Another is, you know, noticeable, that is, you know, a little bit of improvement over the usage of English. Hardly, you know, in the past, you go to, you know, even you go to top-notch restaurants, you do not have a very good English menu. And you probably have, you know, a cake being described as complicated cake. Actually, it's cake with mixed flavors. So, I mean, this kind of improvement. So I'm looking at the bright side from the details, you know, what people in Beijing are actually experiencing.
David Westendorf, we'll look at a lot of these politics internally and externally as well. But Jing Jun there speaks again about the hyper-urbanization, what's happened with Beijing. Melinda began to describe that for us. We should give us a kind of a word picture. I mean, I've seen much of, we were just in the airport, which is brand new and amazing, but beyond that, these buildings really are astounding. The bird's nest that everybody has seen, the cube swimming pool. I mean, the protests may be loud abroad, but if you're in Beijing, it's quite a marvel what has happened there, though not without a price.
I've just got back from Beijing a few hours ago and was treated to, as usual, the daily changes that are occurring in that city. And it's actually quite a nice spring there now, and much of the gardening that has been done to beautify the city is actually bursting out all over the city right now. You come in from the airport. Yeah, you come in from this brand new Foster Airport, which is spectacular, and you're in a city that's a lot greener than it used to be. And
but give us a sense. I mean, we saw an estimate just in the last couple of months here. This is from Huang Wei. He's with the Municipal Commission of Development and Reform for the Olympics and Advisor. 520 billion yuan, he said, $74 billion at today's exchange rate. That is a huge, huge amount of many, many times what's ever been spent before, even if it was at a better exchange rate when they began.
Yes, many, many, many times more than any previous Olympic, even in inflation-adjusted.
How much
has
Beijing been rebuilt, transformed? How much has been leveled to make way for this? And is that a problem?
Well, as Melinda noted, there's this magnificent, I have to say, in the era since the games were approved or given to Beijing, there's been an outstanding upgrading of the architectural design that's been put into the city. It's and the scale is truly astounding of some of these buildings. And it's not entirely just the Olympic buildings that people have seen on television now, but also, as Melinda mentioned, the Rem Koolhaas CCTV tower and so on.
We're talking about the biggest transformation of a city, Melinda believes, maybe perhaps, in history.
I am quite sure that's the case. And Shanghai will probably soon be trying to jig up their answer to Beijing's whole makeover.
But
it's going to be tough. It's going to be really tough. I can't. As a city planner, I can't think of a building project as large as this, except maybe Europe after World War II.
We have to think of the pharaohs and ancient Egypt, maybe.
Well,
maybe.
Maybe.
But of course, with these games, we're thinking of a lot of other things, too, right around the world. We've seen what happened with the torch. I'm trying to figure out exactly how it's playing in China. I'm eager to hear from all of you. We're going to take a short break here, begin to turn to our callers. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're beginning a week of broadcasts live from Shanghai, China. We're talking in this very first hour about the Summer Olympics on their way to China and how the countdown to the Games is playing out in the country that will host them. We're joined in this hour from Beijing, where the Beijing Games will start August 8th by Jing Jun at Tsinghua University by Melinda Liu. She's Beijing Bureau Chief for Newsweek Magazine. And with me in our studios, high above Shanghai, David Westendorf is here, head of Urban China Partners here in Shanghai. You are more than welcome to join the conversation right across the Pacific. What is your question about how the games and the issues around the games are playing out in Beijing, Shanghai, across China? Can you believe the epical preparations China is making for these games? And if this is China's coming out party, what do we see? What's coming out? Let's jump right in with a caller from Nashville, Tennessee. Diane is calling. Hi, Diane. You're on the air in Shanghai.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I understand and I appreciate the luster of urban transformation for the games, but when you mentioned that entire neighborhoods had been raised to make room for various parks and facilities, how has that impacted the actual residents of those neighborhoods, and have they been relocated fairly?
It's a great question, Diane. Let us go to it. Jing Jun, maybe we should come to you. I mean, you're well known for your work with communities that were resettled when the Three Gorges Dam was put up in the middle of China and millions of people displaced by that. What about the Beijing Games? Diane in Nashville wants to know what happened to those people.
The Olympic Games are only part of the problem of, fast urban transformation and the relocation, sometimes compulsory relocation of populations. The city has been undergoing fast urbanization and modernization. And with the Olympic Games coming, and the speed was picked up. So a lot of Chinese intellectuals, a lot of Chinese local residents, Beijing residents, are very sad about the disappearance of historical neighborhoods. Historical courtyard neighborhoods, personally speaking, it's a sad part of the whole story.
David Westendorf, I remember sitting down having dinner with a Chinese family deep in the Hutong, the sort of narrow, crowded, very old neighborhoods of Beijing years ago. I don't know, but I'm guessing where we sat is gone now, paved over by something. What about the loss in that?
Well, there's a pretty good chance that you're right. The loss, as Jing Jun has said, is not just architectural. It's the urban. It's the urban fabric of a unique city that is being taken apart brick by brick, block by block. Efforts have been made to save and protect blocks within blocks, but when you're only doing this piecemeal, you actually do lose the platting of a Yuan Dynasty city. And that says a lot to the people who live there. And so I think it's both a cultural, an urbanistic, and a personal loss for a lot of people. But I do have to say that I know Chinese, young Chinese, middle-aged Chinese, and even some older Chinese who say, well, you know, living in the Hutongs is pretty tough, especially in the winter when you have to go to the potty down the street.
Quaint but cold.
Quaint but cold. And of course, many of the houses were allowed to be run down over a long period of time. And many of the residents are low-income people and do not have the resources to restore a building like that to its original standard, even if it was Yuan Dynasty standard.
Even if it's been there, but it's never going to happen now.
No, it's well, it will happen through gentrification, and that is already happening. And what gentrification will do is take people who share an old Beijing culture from their native place and probably put them at the outskirts of the city at some great distance from where they want to be.
Melinda, help us understand more about how this world reaction to the torch and the games is being received. I'm looking here at an editorial ran in the Chicago Tribune over this past weekend, and you could probably find this in, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of papers across the United States. And they say, whether you support torch snatching as a pre-Olympic event or not, this international embarrassment could hardly be aimed at a more deserving target than China. They're pretty hot. They say the country's list of offenses against humanity is long. Political prisoners, jailed journalists, religious persecution, you name it, they do it. And, you know, they go on to complain about their relationship with Sudan and Darfur and all the rest. I've talked with young Chinese lately. Boy, when you give them that list of condemnation from the West, they get very hot under the collar about it. They push back very hard. But what's your sense? Is there any gap between the government line and how how can you say the people of China? There's 1.3 billion, but ordinary people see the protest abroad against their country and these games around these issues.
I think it's a little early to assess where people's hearts and minds really lie because of the emotions that have been stirred up now. I think there's a lot of short-term anger, resentment, frustration, disappointment, hurt, you know, being expressed that may not still be there a few weeks or months from now. I think the outpouring of nationalistic spirit has taken everyone aback a little bit, including government officials. Okay, basically the dynamic goes like this. For centuries, the nightmare of a ruling regime in China, whether it be communist, Republican, or imperial, was to be seen by your own people as too weak, unable to stand up to foreign bullying. The list is very long. Opium wars, you know, all that.
China has been occupied by Japan, conquered essentially at one point. You know.
Occupied, yes, and you know that Japan has often actually been the target of a lot of nationalistic anger. Okay, so you have a very tragic and still yet to be entirely explained or investigated, series of events in Tibetan areas, violent riots, you know, the protests, violent riots, some kind of government response, loss of life of all ethnic groups, Tibetan, Chinese, and Hui Muslims. Unfortunately, independent media are not allowed to go to those areas now to investigate on their own or to report on their own, so we don't really know exactly what happened, how it happened, what happened first. But anyway, the overwhelming grassroots reaction was, okay, first of all, the government had a lot of TV footage, security camera footage, whatever kind of, you know, visual footage of Chinese being badly attacked, Chinese targets being assaulted, burned,
Han Chinese
and things like that.
In Lhasa and elsewhere in Tibet.
In Lhasa,
yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
So after
hand,
airing this kind of footage,
multiples of, you know, of China, of Tibetans killed reportedly. We don't know the exact numbers and arrests and so on. So, but yes, they
exile
saw
sources
that.
Say that. Yeah, but that wasn't covered here. So, you know, the sequence is very interesting because, you know, okay, first the government wants to show these images, but then the grassroots reaction is, well, why didn't you protect us? You know, why did you, the government, fail to protect? You know,
the Han Chinese,
innocent Chinese Han Chinese against mm-hmm. these evil demon, you know, rioters who are out to kill, you know, it's now called the March 14th looting, beating, smashing and burning incident. So to defend itself against this perception of perhaps they were too weak, indeed, there was a strange hiatus of lack of response for up to 24 hours, maybe, in Lhasa. Mm-hmm. A suitable target, someone to blame, had to be found. And of course, as we all know, the exiled Dalai Lama was described as, you know, being at the root of this evil conspiracy. Later on, the Western media was also added as someone in cahoots with the Dalai Lama because of various perceived distortions. And lo and behold, the Chinese people generally rallied to that and jumped on that bandwagon to the point where it's hard to know if the tail's wagging the dog now. We now see death threats being targeted, being issued against foreign journalists. We see a call to boycott and protest against Carrefour, the French retail chain of supermarkets on May 1st.
Right, and
yes.
The Body Shop, part of L'Oreal.
Body Shop also.
Mm-hmm. This is sort of now, Chinese internet movement underway right now, we read.
Right. I think there's still a question of whether that will really develop into, you know, significant protests. But all we can say is that in the past, when nationalistic Chinese youth have been sort of ginned up and spun up to protest, we have seen the absolute trashing of American, British, and Japanese diplomatic facilities as well as Japanese commercial establishments. So I think there is reason to be quite concerned about this sort of, you know, government riding the tiger of nationalism, not sure how to get off of it, and this animal sort of raging into the future.
Jing Jun in Beijing, a couple of images strike to my mind. I mean, we're in Shanghai, where the young girl Jin Jing, who was in the wheelchair in Paris carrying the torch when the sort of riot broke out there and a huge scuffle around her, she came home to Shanghai this weekend. I mean, she got a hero's welcome like you cannot believe. She's quoted in the papers saying, you know, I'd rather die than let go of the torch. And, you know, the talk about the red carpet. There's one image. Next to that, you know, look abroad, you've got what Der Spiegel, the German magazine, on their cover, the five Olympic rings, you know, retooled to be twined with barbed wire, with everything that suggests. How do you think this is going to work out inside China, Jing Jun?
I think, you know, all these events will turn out to be very good for China, to become very mature in dealing with international issues. And in looking at how other people are looking at us, they're not bad things in the end. I'm saying so because I think on the part of many Chinese citizens, there is a great deal of naivety. And many of them think, you know, this is a great event, and this is our national event, and therefore everyone has to agree, or everyone is expected to agree. And the recent events recall to my mind what happened in Seattle a few years ago when the World Trade Organization was having a huge conference there. We saw looting, we saw burning, we saw, you know, scuffles with police. But I don't think the mayor of Seattle felt terribly humiliated, and the U.S. president felt that, you know, very, very under pressure being humiliated. I think, you know, the reaction to all these events is a measurement of China's maturity gradually in dealing with international issues. So that's why I'm saying, you know, these events are good things in the long run.
Let's take a call from Albion, Iowa, and Terry. Hi, Terry. You're on the air to Shanghai.
Hello, Tom, and thank you for having me on the show.
Good to have you.
First of all, I would like to thank China for hosting the Games, and I wanted to make a comment that I think this is a wonderful opportunity for all the participating nations to begin new relationships and to understand each other better.
And you're very gracious. Do you worry about the things that the protesters complain about in the streets about China, or not?
No, I don't. I think it's something that happens in all countries. We have protests here in the United States. They're all over the world. But we have to look at the positive things and see the good things that are going on. And I think it's wonderful that this is going to start with China having the Games this summer.
Terry, we've got the view and we appreciate it. Thank you very much for your call. Let's get another right here if we can from South Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, and Edwin. Hi, Edwin, you're on the air to Shanghai.
Hello, Tom. I hope the air quality over there is not complicating your recovery at all.
Not too bad today, though. We've talked to people in Beijing who with a little cough.
Exactly. My comment is this. I am old enough to remember the good old days of Jim McKay and the wide world of sports, and I look back with nostalgia at the time when the Olympics were really purely about amateur athletics and that kind of excellence. And I've watched the games gradually go downhill in terms of commercialism and now politicization, and I wonder if this really isn't the beginning of the end of the luster of the Olympic Games. You know, all these guys that are men and women who are going to win medals, they all compete in world championships, and the world championships of these sports are so much purer. And I wonder if the games haven't eventually devolved into a kind of circus that you know, it's just not ever going to recover from.
Edwin, let us pick it up, and thanks for your call. Belinda Liu, do you think China's getting what it bargained for here? Never mind the politics for a moment. Here's a sports fan who says, hey, the Olympics, you know, aren't what they once were. We saw a call on the editorial page of the New York Times, yesterday, for an end to the Olympics after all the hullabaloo. Does China worry about that, Melinda?
Actually, that's a very interesting side story here that maybe has been eclipsed by some of the more dramatic political things going on. China is a perfect example of a big sports power, you know, as well as being a big economic power and everything like that. A sports power with one foot in the old sort of, you know, East German school of training, and then another foot in this hyper commercialized, you know, modern sports circus as
and that is all over the place in China. We see it everywhere.
Exactly. And it's strange to watch the sort of contortions that, you know, I mean, athletes can give endorsements and be paid for them, but they have to give that part of that salary to the state, because basically they're still seen as belonging to the state.
Try that in the United States. Melinda Liu and Jing Jun in Beijing, David Westendorf in Shanghai, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're in Shanghai. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, live from Shanghai. We're talking this hour about the Summer Olympics on their way to China and how the countdown to the Games is playing out in the country that will host them. If you want to see a slideshow, great slideshow of Olympic sites and more information on the Olympics, go to our website, onpointradio.org/China. I'm joined in this hour from Beijing, where the Olympics will be hosted by Jing Jun, professor of sociology at Tsinghua University, best known for his studies on the impact of communities resettled in the Three Gorges Dam Project, and for his work on AIDS in China. Also in Beijing, Melinda Liu, Beijing bureau chief for Newsweek magazine, and with me in our studios this week in Shanghai, China, David Westendorf, head of Urban China Partners. Let's go to Gwen in Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Gwen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My comment is that several years ago, when China got the Olympic bid and beat up my hometown of Toronto in Canada for the bid, you know, there were some very high expectations of, you know, an opening of the world in that respect.
Right.
And I think that the anger over the human rights issues and the Dalai Lama and Tibet that's playing out now, I kind of see it as if that's kind of a cover story for a deeper anger of a lot of consumer anger against China for things that have happened much more recently after the Olympic bid happened. You know, the tainted dog food, the tainted toothpaste, the heparin that just happened, lead paint in toys. All of these are examples of Chinese business corporate cheating and shenanigans. And, you know, with all due respect to the Chinese representative that you have as your guest today, I don't...
Not a Chinese representative, but a citizen of China. Mm-hmm. Gwen, you've got a list there, and let us pick it up. It's very interesting. Linda Liu, and I hope, Gwen, it's not just sour grapes because Toronto didn't get the Games. But we hear your list, and, you know, this idea that the protests over Tibet really have come to take on the weight of a long list of other complaints about China as well. Melinda, what do you say about that? In a funny way, it lines up with some things I've heard out of Chinese officials muttering that these protests, they're also saying it's kind of a cover, and that what it really is some Western pushback against China, you know, with its big debut. This is its moment. This is its coming out, and this is old Western powers pushing back against this big, rich newcomer at the table. Do you see a kind of layers beneath here, Melinda, in the protests?
Yes, Tom. I think Gwen definitely has a point there, although I would caution against describing China as if it were like one unified monolith, just as I would caution against describing the West or characterizing the West as one...
1.3 billion people,
yeah.
That's a lot, and we recognize
basically, China is much more complex than that, as the West is much more complex. And I think Gwen actually spoke to that point by saying Chinese consumers. I actually do think that they're... particularly the protests surrounding the torch relay. I mean, I think there were... There were a number of protests and statements right after the bloodshed in Tibetan areas. But then I think the torch relay was sort of like the second phase. And definitely that was not just about the Dalai Lama and stuff. I mean, we saw a coming together in San Francisco of a very diverse sort of rainbow coalition of critics of China over Darfur, over the lack of press freedoms, over Tibet, of course, and even protesters opposing Chinese policies in the far western Muslim areas of China, and
the Uyghurs,
exactly, and mm-hmm. and the definitely, I think at the grassroots there are many Americans who actually don't know much about the ins and outs of the Chinese Politburo. You know, Tibet is very far away for them, so is Darfur. But, you know, this whole issue of tainted food and tainted toys and you know, toxic heparin. I mean, these are things that can really come home to, you know, very, very grassroots Americans. And I think that that sort of fear combined with the perception of China as a big power. I mean, you know, 1.3 billion people, that's a huge country. I do think that we do see some of that. I don't think that all Americans feel that way. I don't think that the Chinese authorities are necessarily correct in saying this is the West, you know, trying to stop us from, you know, showing our confidence in our new stature in the world. I think on both sides it's more complicated than that.
We've got a call from Socrates, no less, in the home of the Olympics, Athens, Greece. Socrates, welcome. You're on the air with On Point in Shanghai. Hi. What do you think?
Hi, good morning, everyone. I hope you can hear me.
Morning or evening, depending where you are in the world.
I'm in Athens, Greece right now.
Yes.
Internet. I hope you can hear me okay. Good morning, gentlemen.
Very well.
And everyone to your guests. Several points. First of all, the Olympic torch was made as an athletic event, not a political event. I mean, going back to the boycott of the 80s and 84, these were all motivated political events, and I think this is what's happening right now. Second of all, if you think of the human rights records that the China has had, and it's been publicly available, okay, I'm making that point, compared to that of the U.S., and I'm thinking, you know, Guantanamo, nonetheless, I don't think that it's a fair game to have the U.S. or the French or the British protesting over what's going on.
You know, in fairness, Socrates, it's not – I mean, we recognize those powers have certainly seen protests, but also we've seen in Indonesia, in Africa. I see the Nobel Prize winner, Wangari Maathai, who was supposed to be part of it. She dropped out. It is not only in the countries that you've mentioned, but we've got your point, and we appreciate your call from the home of the Olympics in Greece. David Westendorf, you've lived in China a long time, fluent in Chinese. You read the papers, you watch the television, and we should give us a sense of how omnipresent these games have been in the Chinese media, and then how this recent turbulence abroad has been portrayed.
Mm. Well, for me, it is complete overkill. I sit with my parents-in-law to watch the evening news and
Shanghai News and
Shanghai and the national news, mm-hmm. and at least half of all the commercials have Olympic symbolism in them, if not outright mm-hmm. reminders that it's X number of days and hours away. And that goes on through the evening news, and I usually the evening programming, so I have to leave because I can't bear.
And never mind the programming itself. But, I mean, I've been watching some, and the promos go on and on. They are there.
They go on and on, and all of the major newspapers have special sections frequently about the progress towards building the stadiums and getting the volunteers all ready to go to cheer
What about the protests around the world? I can't read these as well as you, but I've been looking at a lot of newspapers here. Here's one from the economic zone in Shenzhen. And the front page, it's all about the Shanghai torch bearing. You would not know from the photos here that there was any problem there. It's all happy, smiling people, photographs of Chinese or American Chinese waving Chinese flags, but not any of the other signs.
Well, that's part of my disappointment is that not only did the Chinese say that they would improve their human rights record, but that they would also be more open to the outside world, and that this was to help Chinese people themselves become more aware of and interested in the rest of the world, like the United States, a big continental power. So sometimes we and they both look inward and not mm-hmm. so much outward. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, to be more open to, I would say, information coming in. And the information that I read in the newspapers here is very one-sided, and I'm afraid that harms. It creates an additional tension to this Olympics, because I think if people had more information, there would be a certain reticence about getting really ginned up. That this is the foreigners picking on us. Mm.
Jingjun, I want to hear you on that in Beijing, but let me take a call or two first, if I may. One from Boston. Simon is calling from Boston. Hi, Simon. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Chinese living and studying in the U.S. for 6 years, and as one of Chinese, I'm really proud of my home country to hold this Olympic Games, and this is a good opportunity to show the world around, you know, what modern China looks like. And I just feel that there's a great knowledge gap and culture gap between China and the Western world nowadays. And just comments on the recent torch relay. Many of my friends, we feel disappointed and even angry because we think the medium here in the U.S. or in Western world overall is not covered fairly. Because as a Chinese, we have the unique opportunity to look at both sides. We can read the English news and also the Chinese news. And in the Chinese
news, if you have access to all that news, but as David Westendorf was saying, many in China, of course, do not.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand why Chinese in China don't have the English side, the Western side.
Or even in the Chinese newspapers, a lot of what's happening abroad, it looks to me, is very, very thinly covered.
I don't think so. If you really understand Chinese, I think you should go to a Chinese website or even YouTube. You know, there's a lot of videos.
Of course,
showing, especially in the recent event in Tibet. I think the most, you know, the important question, who attacked who, is not, you know, Chinese government send armies to crack down Tibet's residents. And on the other side, you know, our normal residents was attacked by a Rus, you know. That's what we see
yes.
from the video, from the picture.
Yeah, we see that.
And as many of my Chinese friends here is from the Western medium, we didn't see at all these pictures, these videos. And it's just, you know, all texts, all people bashing China, what they do, what they destroy the, you know, the human rights.
Simon, our time grows short, but we've got it. A lot of sympathy demonstrated for the Dalai Lama around the world, but in China, they talk about the Dalai Lama clique. Let me get another call right here, if I may, from Iowa City, Iowa. And David. David, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, guests. Building on what the last caller's comments were about, it seemed to me a lack of knowledge about the events that transpired in China and Tibet, decades ago up until now, there are about 1,000 students and Chinese nationals at the university here, and I've worked with a number of them, and I've had conversations over the years with many, and especially about events surrounding Tiananmen Square, and I was stunned at the lack of knowledge of the significance of the events, of the brutality of the Chinese government's response, and I've even had a couple of conversations in which the Chinese nationals simply said that they know that it is forbidden to read about this, and they have fear of even reading about these events here in the United States. And so how can we expect any kind of balance or any kind of understanding of the events surrounding the Olympics and the protests if Chinese citizens living in China and Chinese nationals abroad don't understand and don't have any access to their own history. And
David, we've got it. Our time is short, but there's each side, you know, saying the other side doesn't know what it's talking about. Jingjun in Beijing, let me ask you, there's an interesting story in the Wall Street Journal in the last couple of days pointing out that when the Olympics came to South Korea, to Seoul, in the 1980s, they were seen, the fact that they came, was seen as really instrumental in encouraging, prompting, helping South Korea move toward democracy. We don't really see a counterpart movement in China. Why not? If the Olympics encouraged democracy in South Korea, why not in China?
I think the Olympic Games are going to encourage the internet, the deeper internationalization of Chinese society. And in terms of business, you know, like enterprises, like trade, China is already deeply part of the world, of the international community.
But that's internationalization. What about democratization? Do you see them encouraging that or not?
Right now, the issue here in dealing with democratization, it's not part of the Olympic Games. I don't see that happening. Here, you know, on one hand, you know, there is a politicalization of the games, and then the Chinese government and a lot of Chinese people got really offended. And on the other hand, you know, people are using these events to raise political issues. And I'm actually very sad about this this situation. If we remember the history, the Greeks used to put the wars on hold, you know, their civil wars on hold, and let their athletes compete as a matter of communication. And I hope these games in Beijing will reach the goal of what people used to do hundreds of years ago.
Not so far in 2008, but what a giant event it's going to be in Beijing. Giant already in unexpected ways around the world. We are broadcasting all week long from Shanghai, China, and we're going to dive into a lot this week. You'll hear it. I want to thank my guests in this hour. It's great to have all of you. Qing Jun at Tsinghua University in Beijing, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Melinda Liu with Newsweek in Beijing. Melinda, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And David Westendorf with Urban China Partners with me in Shanghai. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Tom.
From Shanghai, live, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.